Burr.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, at summary judgment, the district court rejected plaintiff's legal theory. Usually, when that happens, plaintiff loses and the case is over. This case is a cautionary tale of what can happen if instead the district court decides to craft and substitute a brand new legal theory for plaintiffs. And here this led to two fundamental errors. First, the district court misapplied the new legal theory of unilateral contract and ignored a crucial exception to it. Then, the district court compounded the error by granting summary judgment class-wide, even though the case was never class-certified under the court's new theory. Between 2007 and 2010, Panera told store managers that they might receive a bonus known as a buyout payment.
Let me ask you a question, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't understand you to be arguing, I guess, that a district court or any other court can't decide a case on the basis of a legal argument that wasn't advanced by either party, are you?
I'm not arguing that itself was error. I'm arguing that the departure from the ordinary procedures has led the district court into error by perhaps not fully understanding the issue.
Well, it happens all the time. When I was a district judge, I probably decided cases more often than not on principles. The job is to get the law right,
not
to decide who's closer.
I agree, Your Honor. Unfortunately, in this case, the district court did not get the law right.
Okay, well, that's a different argument.
Of course, and that is my argument, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Panera told store managers that they might receive a bonus known as a buyout payment, but only if they worked 5 years and remained employed on the payout date, both of which Panera had total discretion to prevent, and only if their stores met certain profitability requirements during the fourth and fifth years of work, measured against a benchmark that Panera had total discretion to determine.
What significance do you think is that it is that Panera didn't implement this new cap through the store profit hurdle route?
I don't think that it's of any significance that they didn't do that here. The point is, for purposes of how the district court analyzed the case, the point is that they had the right to do that. The point is that
they didn't use that.
No, they didn't use that.
Provision of the contract.
Absolutely not.
Is it simply out of the case at this point?
I think that the fact that they didn't use it is out of the case.
Okay.
Yes. In 2011, as the court I'm sure knows, which was years before most of the managers had worked the crucial fourth and fifth years, and before some had worked 2 or 3 years, Panera announced any bonus would be capped at $100,000. The managers received monthly notice of the cap. They were paid under the terms of the capped offer, and nobody objected until years later in 2014. The chief question in this case is whether the managers who eventually completed their fourth and fifth years were performing the original offer or the new capped offer that they were paid for. The district court was correct when it concluded that what plaintiffs should have asserted is that the bonus offer was an offer for a unilateral contract that could be accepted through performance. Where the district court went wrong was its conclusion that Panera was powerless to change its unilateral offer when it did so. The district court relied on a general legal rule that a unilateral contract is freely revocable only until substantial performance, at which point it becomes irrevocable.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Missouri law,
if I may.
Substantial performance. I think that the law with respect to how much performance is necessary before we can say that an offer for unilateral contracts has been accepted has migrated some over the years. In particular, if you look at the more modern restatements of contract, and as you know, the Missouri courts frequently rely on restatements for their contract law and other law, you'll see that there's a new phrase that's used, and that is not substantial performance, but part performance. And I think that this migration represents more than just language. I think maybe the principle has changed in a way that makes it possible for performance on the part of the offeree to be somewhat more truncated than it might be under a substantial performance standard. How much is enough?
Well, I would
either
say
part or substantial. How much is enough?
Sure. In this case, Your Honor, nothing but full performance is enough because of the language of the offer itself. Now, I will address your question, if I might, but I wanted to establish the legal principle first that the district court missed. The district court ignored the exception that applies that when the offer to pay itself makes clear that the obligation to pay can be canceled any time prior to full performance, then we don't look at the substantial performance issue at all, whether it's substantial part or anything else. The exception recognizes that there can be no justifiable reliance on an offer like Panera's.
Where could it be canceled at any time?
Sure. It could be canceled any time. It was clear that these employees were not ever going to receive their bonus unless and until they worked the fourth and fifth years, and, this is important, they were present on the payout date. That was clear. They weren't going to get anything. Now, under Missouri law, employees at will can, if they're promised a bonus, they can, and they're fired before they are able to complete their performance, they might be entitled to a pro rata share of the bonus. But, and this is important, the cases make clear, that's not true if they have to be there according to the offer on the payout date. And that's exactly what Panera's offer said. So these folks had no justifiable reliance to think that part performance or substantial performance or anything other than full performance was going to get them anywhere. That is the rule of law that the district court missed. Our offer was also specifically based on the store profit hurdle, but it specifically said in the offer, hey, we can change that too. Again, no basis to rely that this was going to be on the table when they got to the end.
So you're saying the hurdle still is in the case?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's only there for the purpose of showing that we had the right to revoke the offer.
So you're still relying on that provision as part of your argument.
It goes to the issue of our right to revoke and therefore the exception to the restatement rule about substantial performance.
It has to do with the question of how much performance is required.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that, yes, in the sense that it shows that there had to be full performance.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, in that sense, yes, that it was fully revocable.
Do you consider the case of Cook on which the district court relied consistent with the later case of Morrill versus Hallmark Cards?
Sure. Well, they're very different in the sense that Cook, which I'm glad you raised that, Judge Loken, the district court asked the parties only after summary judgment had already been briefed to do a supplemental brief about whether this was in fact a unilateral contract or a bilateral contract and pointed to Cook. Now, Cook is a case in which there was full performance before there was an attempted revocation. So to that extent, it certainly shows a certain level of performance that might be expected. Morrill was a different case in that is a situation in which the employer was not trying to modify a unilateral contract offer that it had reserved the right to modify, but it was trying to impose a new obligation on the plaintiff. It was trying to say, you have to arbitrate, and that was it.
The cap was a new obligation. It a term or was it a contract?
The cap was essentially a replaced unilateral offer that Panera had the right to replace. We had the full right to revoke and replace the offer, and that's what we did. And by the way, these folks worked for years afterwards without complaining about it. And then they took the money, and they kept the money for years afterwards until 2014. So I'm glad you raised the issue of substantial performance. Judge Loken, I didn't know you weren't finished.
Well, I've tried to come in three times. You just keep talking. Was this an employment agreement in the sense of moral statement that you have to have an employment contract to enforce an arbitration clause, or was this a term of and condition of an at-will employment relationship?
Well, it was certainly characterized as an employment agreement. It was part and parcel.
Characterized by whom?
That's what it was called. I mean, there was an employment agreement, and then there was a bonus agreement, and they were tied together. There's no question about it. It's simply not a contract because the promises were all illusory by everybody. Panera had the right to get out of it, and the plaintiffs had the right, and the managers had the right to quit. So that's why the district court correctly found that it was, in fact, nothing but an offer for a unilateral contract. I would also say that even if substantial performance was the touchstone.
Wait, an offer, if it's an offer for a unilateral contract and an employment at will relationship, it's a term or condition of employment. The only thing the employer has promised is if you do this, I'll pay you.
That's right.
All right. Now, but this has additional, I mean, the bonus, the specific futuristic bonus provision makes this a little bit different. I didn't see any discussion by the district court of which this was and why.
There was no further discussion about it. The district court simply said, well, it's substantial performance, therefore it was irrevocable, ignored the comment to the restatement, and didn't explain why 1 year of performance was substantial. Now, the district court was applying the substantial.
You're saying the district court's legal analysis was contrary to the legal analysis in Morrow?
I think that to some extent, yes, although Morrow wasn't involving an offer of anything. And so it wasn't a unilateral contract in the sense it wasn't offering a bonus. It was just simply trying to enforce as if it was a bilateral contract, an arbitration agreement.
Every time an at-will employee is hired, that's an offer.
I'm sorry?
Every time an at-will employee is hired.
Yes.
That's an offer of a unilateral contract.
I agree.
As much as you work, I'll pay you.
I agree. That's correct. I agree with that.
It's complete. And, you know, that's not what I'm reading in this case. This case flops all over the at-will doctrine.
No, I don't disagree with you at all, Judge Loken. Instead of on the substantial performance question, it's clear these folks couldn't get anything unless they worked fourth and fifth years. The district court, instead of acknowledging the centrality of the fourth and fifth years, insisted that working 4 or 5 years was not at all a condition of payout. The court said those are just used to measure the amount of bonus, but if they didn't work the fourth or fifth years, they got nothing. So that sounds like a condition to me. And similarly, the variability as to how long they all worked after getting the cap.
Well, it's a condition of payment. It's not necessarily a condition for the formation of a contract.
That's true.
It's a different
Agreed. But again,
no,
it goes to
I don't see how you can say that that's a requirement of something called substantial performance.
Well, because under Missouri law, under the Ketcherside case, under Cook, substantial performance is measured by what's the crux of the offer and the performance.
They perform,
but the issue is, did they perform before the offer was modified? That was what the district court hung its hat on.
Okay, well, I'm repeating myself.
No, that's what the district court hung its hat on, that it was irrevocable.
I just have a couple of quick questions. This relationship is documented with an employment and confidentiality agreement,
yes.
Correct? And then a joint venture general manager compensation plan.
Yes.
And those are the documents we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's specifically this compensation plan that's the focus of what's happened here.
That's correct.
All right. Now, and these documents are signed by the company and these managers.
I believe that's correct.
And they in the text, it refers to them as agreements.
That is correct.
And the compensation plan says that this plan is a final and complete exclusive agreement. And then says no modification or waiver shall be valid unless in writing signed by the party against whom the same is sought to be enforced.
That is what it says.
What's the significance of that, requirement for modification
sure.
to be in writing?
Then
secondly, hasn't the company modified this plan?
So the significance legally, essentially under Missouri law, is not much, although the plaintiffs would like it to be. Under Missouri law, that kind of clause is basically void ab initio in the sense that the parties are always free to modify even in and orally, even if it says they can't. And by the way, because Panera's new capped offer met all the requirements of a unilateral contract offer, they did meet the requirements of a new contract that's valid. And I would point the court to Jennings versus SSM, which is where that is exactly what the issue was.
So the answer to the question is, you think that it has no significance?
I don't think that it helped plaintiffs at all. That's correct.
Thank you.
I see that my time has expired. I would like to point out, of course, that it is also, by granting summary judgment class-wide without ever doing a Rule 23 class certification analysis, I think that's error right there. And our briefs make clear that had the court followed the proper procedure, certification would not have been allowed, because there are a lot of individualized issues here, including either we win or the substantial performance is an individualized issue, or there's estoppel, all of which. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Tim Cofield. I represent the plaintiff class and appellees. Panera is asking this court to rewrite this contract. We brought a copy of the contract here today. Judge Loken, we're referring to our addendum, which is a copy of the contract at issue here. So it's the first 13 pages of the class member's addendum. On page 12 of the addendum, section 5D of the JVGM compensation plan contains an integration clause. It says this is the final agreement between the parties with respect to any compensation. It incorporates the employment and confidentiality agreement that has been discussed. And then it says that no modification or waiver of this agreement shall be valid unless in writing signed by the party against whom it's to be enforced. This provision is binding in Missouri to prevent unilateral modification by either party. It can only be overridden. Can only be overridden if the parties engage in modification by valid contractual formalities. That was the holding in Jennings that counsel mentioned, where the employee had a written employment contract, and he and the employer later got together and they entered into an oral severance agreement. Hey, if you work another 6 months, we'll pay you severance. And it was fine because there was consideration flowing in both directions. But here we have this agreement, and Panera is just trying.
That's only true if the compensation plan is not a term or condition of an at-will employment contractual relationship.
So, Judge Loken, if I understand you correctly, you're referring to the language in Morrow that says an at-will employer is free to add correct. Additional terms or conditions of employment, and the employee can say yes or no, basically, and continue or quit. Is that correct?
Well, yes, which is consistent with my longstanding understanding of at-will relationships.
So what Morrow held is that an employer cannot gift itself new contractual rights based on the at-will nature of employment. An employer cannot say, hey, if you continue working for me, then you've consented to be bound by an arbitration agreement. This case is no different from that situation. We have this contract, which was binding at the time both parties signed it, because the class members entered into numerous enforceable promises, and I'll come back to that, Your Honor. But we had a set of contractual rights in this written document that both parties signed. And one of those contractual rights that the class members had, that Panera had promised them, was if you earn a buyout, it's going to be paid in an amount determined by this very specific formula. That was the status quo here. Morrow had nothing like that. Morrow, there was no written employment agreement. The employer just published a policy and said, hey, if you continue working, you
counsel,
can send arbitration.
Counsel, get off Morrow on the facts. I was talking about its legal analysis.
Yes, sir.
Cook is closer on the facts than this case, but I'm not sure Cook applies to this case. I think Morrow's and that description of the at-will relationship is accurate.
It is accurate if you don't have pre-existing contractual rights and obligations. Here we had this contract that the parties entered into where Panera had an obligation to follow the buyout formula. That was the status quo.
Counsel, not you're now assuming your failed bilateral contract theory. on the district court's analysis, the original employment agreement and compensation plan were not an enforceable bilateral contract. It was an at-will relationship, right?
Employment was at will, but the power to end an employment relationship does not in any way imply a power to revoke contractual promises or to amend contractual promises.
All right, where do you get that?
Well, I get it from the language of this agreement. It's very clear from this agreement, there's no dispute that Panera could have terminated these employees' employment.
Yes, but the compensation plan was explicitly made a part of the at-will employment contract. So therefore, it is, if I had been pursuing the case originally, I would have done it the way you did, which was to say these two documents together made an enforceable bilateral relationship. But you lost that, although you've argued it on appeal and perhaps may be correct. But if it's a unilateral, if it's an at-will relationship from the outset, then it seems to me the district court's analysis breaks down.
The district court's analysis was correct under, if you look at it as a unilateral contract or a bilateral contract, Your Honor. To use your terms, we had an at-will employment relationship here. Okay, and that means that this written contract, this 12-page document, was simply an offer to make a unilateral contract. And the law is very clear on this point. Cook is very clear on this point, that an offer can be revoked at any time prior to acceptance unless it's supported by consideration. And so then what's consideration? Consideration is a promise to do or to refrain from doing something that's legally binding. And this document that the class members sign is rife with consideration. It is filled with all sorts of goodies that Panera wanted. We've got a contractual agreement to waive their right to a jury trial. That's enforceable under the Missouri Supreme Court's decision in Milan Realty. We've got provisions limiting damages, consequential or punitive damages. That's enforceable under the Supreme Court's decision in Purcell Tire. We've got a forum selection clause that required these employees to come to Missouri for any dispute arising out of their employment. That's a huge promise. It's enforceable under the Missouri Supreme Court's decision in Highline Sales. It's 823 Southwest 2nd 493. It's got a non-disclosure covenant where these employees promise not to disclose any of the information they glean from their time working for Panera. That is a massive promise that it's enforceable against them. As an example, I'll cite this court's decision in Hallmark Cards versus Murley, 703 Federal 3rd 556. That's a 2013 opinion affirming a jury verdict in favor of an employer who sued an employee for violating a non-disclosure agreement virtually identical to the one contained in this employment and confidentiality agreement, and upholding the damages award.
Counsel, what's your view of what the Missouri law is with respect to the kind of performance by the offeree that will create the contract?
Well, assuming that we're dealing with an offer that was not initially supported by consideration, and again, I think there was, for those reasons.
I'm talking about the district court's theory.
We're talking about the length of performance that's required.
Yeah.
I think that Missouri courts follow the first restatement and the second restatement, which is that the beginning of performance or part performance is sufficient consideration to bind the offeror to his or her offer. The Kaufman decision and the Cook decision, they both cite the treatise Corbin on Contracts that has this language that says, as soon as the offeree renders a substantial part of the requested performance, then the offeror is bound by his promise. So is that a little bit more strenuous than part performance?
That's my question.
Maybe, but if you look at the actual decisions that Missouri courts have come to in dealing with attempted revocations of unilateral contracts, they just follow the first restatement. As soon as the offeree begins performance in earnest, that binds the offeror to this implied subsidiary promise that if you finish your performance, I'm going to pay you what I promised to pay you. If we look at
all the cases that I've seen from Missouri, rather courts of appeals, I think, isn't that right? There's not much out of the Supreme Court on the question of how much is substantial or how much is part of whatever you want to call it.
We have a few Missouri Courts of Appeals opinions. One I'd like to direct the court's attention to is Kaufman. This was the first time.
There's nothing out of the Supreme Court, right?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor.
Okay. So this is our best evidence of what Missouri law is, but that's all it is, which is a lot. I don't mean it's nothing, but okay.
I think Kaufman's a good example. In that case, an insurer offered to pay a claim if a subcontractor would resolve a collateral claim, and the court held that by beginning negotiations to resolve that collateral claim and forbearing to sue, the subcontractor, the offeree, bound that insurer to that settlement offer. They didn't have to actually settle the claim. They just had to begin the negotiations. That was the requested performance. In Ketcherside versus McLean, another case that we discussed in our brief, the offer was an oral offer to conduct an auction. And what did the auctioneer do? Well, he inventoried and he marked the items to get them ready for auction, which was significant, but he didn't even begin conducting the auction itself. And the court held that was sufficient performance to bind the offeror to the offer. And that auctioneer got paid for that auction, even though he didn't even conduct it. Here, these 67 class members, they all fully performed all 5 years. They did everything this contract asked.
Counsel, let me come at that a little differently. In 2012, when Panera went around apparently to groups of these general managers, if they'd come into a meeting with 20 general managers and announced, we're now going to cap the bonuses at $100,000, and a manager stood up and said, we don't accept that, it's not fair. And Panera then said, then you're all fired. Did you contact?
I think that would be bad faith. It didn't happen. But
forget bad faith. If your initial bilateral contract theory is correct, that might be a breach of contract. But if the compensation plan is a term or condition of an at-will relationship, I think you'd have to agree that Panera could have said that. And, of course, what then would have happened was bargaining or individual treatment of particular general managers depending on how the regard they were held in.
Exactly, Your Honor. I agree that's what should have happened, is there should have been bargaining here.
Now, this name plaintiff wasn't in that kind of a session. So why is his, under the district court's unilateral contract theory, why is he similarly situated? Why is there a commonality on a critical point with the managers who were in those meetings and who did not object?
Well, 2 points. One, all 67 class members learned about this buyout cap before they were actually capped. Some of them, it was because they were given a PowerPoint presentation. With respect to the named plaintiffs, they learned about it in different ways, either through emails or because Panera posted a footnote on its website or its intranet announcing the cap. They all knew about it. So that's the crux of Panera's defense. It's always been, you know, we told these people we were going to cap buyouts before we capped the buyouts. And that, you know, that applies equally to everyone, regardless of whether they sat in on a PowerPoint presentation. But more importantly than that, the defense fails as a matter of law, because the fact that Panera announced it was going to impose a buyout cap in and of itself doesn't have any legal significance. Why not? Because in order to modify this contract, there had to be two things. There had to be additional consideration flowing in both directions, and there had to be mutual assent. Now, the Missouri Court of
Appeals... Well, now you just went back to the theory you lost.
Well, Your Honor, it's the theory we've always had whenever the court has asked us about it. I'm not going to shy away from it now. I think the court was right under her unilateral contract analysis. I think she was right under her bilateral contract analysis. It doesn't matter because this, as I've explained, the terms of this written document became binding on Panera long before it told people it was going to impose a cap.
So your under your theory, your bilateral contract theory, your the language you have on the board is really that's it that is insignificant with respect to your theory. The requirement for a writing.
It's highly significant. Well, the requirement for a writing is not so much significant as it is. The
well, that's what I thought you just said, that there had to be consideration, et cetera, but I haven't heard you reference the requirement for a writing, so I've just assumed that under your theory, whether there's a requirement for a writing in order to modify or no requirement for a writing in order to modify, your theory would still have merit, is what I'm hearing you say.
That's correct, Your Honor. The requirement of a writing is not as important here as the prohibition on unilateral modification. In Baker, the proposed arbitration agreement there had a specific provision that said, hey, we the employer, we can unilaterally amend this any time. And the Supreme Court said, hey, that's not a contract because that party can amend its obligations.
Now this provision really isn't in the case, because what this provision has to do with is writing. And what you're saying is, no, it's just the usual common law of modification that applies. There has to be some validity to the modification. It can't be a unilateral one. Some contractual validity. The writing is out of the case, right?
I agree that it's possible to orally amend a contract.
Even with this kind of provision in it.
With this kind of provision,
exactly.
If you have consideration flowing in both directions.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the theory is that even this provision can be modified through formal contractual negotiations, and therefore the writing thing is simply the writing requirement simply drops out of the contract.
The important part is no unilateral modification. I'm out of time, Your Honors. Thank you. We ask that you affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you very much. Does counsel have any time?
No.
I'll give you a minute to wrap up if you'd like.
I think that it speaks volumes that counsel refuses to defend the district court's own judgment in its favor, because the district court's judgment was rife with error. I also want to point out that this reference to the lead argument for Panera, and what I want to leave with, is that its initial offer remained fully revocable. Substantial performance or part performance didn't change that, because the offer itself allowed it to be fully revocable. Counsel referred to this notion that, well, it stopped being fully revocable if it was supported by consideration. I never really explained what that meant, but I traced that language back to the case of Sokol versus Hill, 310 Southwest 2nd, 19. All that means is that if the offeree pays the offeror to keep the offer open, and then in that sense gives consideration, then it's not freely revocable. But other than that, unilateral offer remains freely revocable. And here it did so because those were the terms of the offer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Does that complete our calendar for this morning?